It is my method not to try to solve problems so far as the solubility and insolubility of problems permits in whatever narrow specializations of thought I find them stated, but, if, for instance, I come upon a mystery that the spiritualists have taken over, to have an eye for data that may have bearing, from chemical, zoological, meteorological, sociological, or entomological sources being unable to fail, of course, because the analog of anything electrical, or planetary, is findable in biological, ethical, or political phenomena. We shall travel far, even to unborn infants, to make hailstones reasonable. I have so many heresies along with my almost incredible credulities or pseudo-credulities, seeing that I have freed my mind of beliefs that, mostly, I cannot trace my infidelities, or enlightenments, back to their sources. But I do remember when first I doubted the denial by conventional science of the existence of prenatal markings. I read Dr. Weissman's book upon this subject, and his arguments against the possibility of prenatal markings convinced me that they are quite possible. And this conversion cost me something. Before reading Dr. Weissman, I had felt superior to peasants, or the man in the street, as philosophers call him, whose belief is that pregnant women, if frightened, mark their offsprings with representations of rats, spiders, or whatever, or, if having a longing for strawberries, fruitfully illustrate their progeny, and were at one time of much service to melodrama. I don't know about the rats and the strawberries, but Dr. Weissman told of such cases as that of a woman with a remarkable and distinctive disfigurement of an ear, and of her similarly marked offspring. His argument was that thousands of women are disfigured in various ways, and that thousands of offsprings are disfigured, and that it is not strange that in one case the disfigurement of an offspring should correspond to the disfigurement of a parent. But so he argued about other remarkable cases, and left me in a state of mind that has often repeated, and that is with the idea that much mental development is in rising down to the peasants again. If there can be prenatal markings of bodies, and, as I interpret Dr. Weissman's denials, there can be, and, if they be of mental origin, my mind is open to the idea that other and still more profoundly damned stories of strange markings may be similarly explained. If a conventional physician is scornful, hearing of a human infant, prenatally marked, I'd like to hear his opinion of a story that I take from the London Daily Express, May 14, 1921. Kitten, born at Nice, France, white belly distinctly marked with the grey figures, 1921. The mother cat had probably been looking intently at something, such as a calendar, so dated. Or reading a newspaper, said scornful doctor would ask, pointing out that, if I think there are talking dogs, it is only a small extension, as I'd call it, to think of educated cats keeping themselves informed upon current events. London Sunday News, August 3, 1926. Dorothy Parrott, 4-year-old child of R.S. Parrott, of Wingate Mill, Georgia, was marked by a red spot on her body. Out of this spot formed three letters, RJC doctors cannot explain. London Daily Express, November 17, 1913. Phenomena of a girl, aged 12, of the village of Bussy-Bussouel, near Abbeville, France. If asked questions, answers appeared in letterings on her arms, legs, and shoulders. Also upon her body appeared pictures, such as of a ladder, a dog, a horse. In September 1926, a Romanian girl, Eleanor Z. Gunn, was taken to London for observation by the National Laboratory for Psychical Research. Countess Vasilko Serecki, who had taken the girl to London, said, in an interview, London Evening Standard, October 1, 1926, that she had seen the word Dracoform upon the girl's arm. This word is the Romanian word for the devil. Or the handwriting on the wall, and why don't I come out frankly in favor of all, or anyway a goodly number of, the yarns, or the data, of the Bible? The defender of some of the faith is clearly becoming my title. In recent years I have noted much that has impressed upon my mind the thought that religionists have taken over many phenomena, as exclusively their own have colored and discredited with their emotional explanations, but that someday some of these occurrences will be rescued from theological interpretations and exploitations, and will be the subject matter of new enlightenments and new dogmas, new progresses, delusions, freedoms, and tyrannies. I incline to the acceptance of many stories of miracles, but think that these miracles would have occurred, if this earth had been inhabited by atheists. To me, the Bible is folklore, and therefore is not pure fantasy, but comprises much that will be rehabilitated. But also to me the Bible is non-existent. This is in the sense that, except in my earlier writings, I have drawn a deadline, for data, at the year 1800. I may, upon rare occasions, dip farther back, but my notes start in the year 1800. I shall probably raise this limit to 1850, or maybe 1900. I take for a principle that our concern is not in marvels. It is in repetitions, or sometimes in almost the commonplace. There is no desirability in going back to antiquity for data, because, unless phenomena be appearing now, they are of only historical interest. At present, there is too much history. Handwritings on walls, I have several accounts, but, if anybody should be interested enough to look up this phenomenon for himself, he will find the most nearly acceptable record in the case of Esther Cox, of Amherst, Nova Scotia. This case was of wide notoriety, and, of it, it could be said that it was well investigated, if it can be supposed that there ever has been a case of anything that has been more than glanced at, or more than painstakingly and profoundly studied, simply to confirm somebody's theory. If I should tell of a woman, who, by mental picturings, not only marked the body of her unborn infant, but transformed herself into the appearance of a tiger, or a lamppost, or became a were-tiger, or a were-a-lamppost, or of a magician, who, beginning with depicting forest scenes on window glass, had learned to transform himself into a were-deer, or a were-tree, I'd tell of a kind of sorcery that used to be of somewhat common occurrence. I have a specimen. It is a Ceylon leaf insect. It is a were-leaf. The leaf insect's likeness to a leaf is too strikingly detailed to permit any explanation of accidental resemblance. There are butterflies, which, with wings closed, look so much like dried leaves that at a distance of a few feet they are indistinguishable from dried leaves. There are tree hoppers with the appearance of thorns, stick insects, cinder beetles, spiders that look like buds of flowers. In all instances these are highly realistic portraitures, such as the writer, who described the portrait of Dean Liddell, on the church wall, would call the handiwork of a master artist. There have been so many instances of this miracle that I now have a theory that, of themselves, men never did evolve from lower animals, but that, in early and plastic times, a human being from somewhere else appeared upon this earth, and that many kinds of animals took him for a model, and rudely and grotesquely imitated his appearance, so that, today, though the gorillas of the Congo, and of Chicago, are only caricatures, some of the rest of us are somewhat passable imitations of human beings. The conventional explanation of the leaf insect, for instance, is that once upon a time a species of insects somewhat resembled leaves of trees, and that the individuals that most closely approximated to this appearance had the best chance to survive, and that in succeeding generations, still higher approximations were still better protected from their deceived enemies. An intelligence from somewhere else, not well acquainted with human beings or whatever we are but knowing of the picture galleries of this earth, might, in Darwinian terms, just as logically explain the origin of those pictures that canvases that were daubed on, without purpose, appeared, and that the daubs that more clearly represented something recognizable were protected, and that still higher approximations had a still better chance, and that so appeared, finally, highly realistic pictures. Though the painters had been purposeless, and with no consciousness of what they were doing. Which contrasts with anybody's experience with painters, who are not only conscious of what they're doing, but are likely to make everybody else conscious of what they're so conscious of. It is not merely that hands of artists have painted pictures upon canvas, it is that, upon canvas, artists have realized their imaginings. But, without hands of artists, strikingly realistic pictures and exquisite modelings have appeared. It may be that for crosses on window panes, emblems on hailstones, faces on church walls, prenatal markings, the stigmata, telepathic transferences of pictures, and leaf insects we shall conceive of one expression. To the clergyman who told the story of the hailstones of Remiremont, the most important circumstance was that, a few days before the occurrence, the town council had forbidden a religious procession, and that, at the time of the fall of the hailstones, there was much religious excitement in Remiremont. English Mechanic, 87-436. Story told by Abbe Gueniot, of Remiremont. That, upon the afternoon of the 26th of May, 1907, the Abbe was in his library, aware of a hailstorm, but paying no attention to it, when a woman of his household called to him to see the extraordinary hailstones that were falling. She told him that images of Our Lady of the Treasures were printed on them. In order to satisfy her, I glanced carelessly at the hailstones, which she held in her hand. But, since I did not want to see anything, and moreover could not do so, without my spectacles, I turned to go back to my book. She urged, "I beg of you to put on your glasses." I did so, and saw very distinctly on the front of the hailstones, which were slightly convex in the center, although the edges were somewhat worn, the bust of a woman, with a robe that was turned up at the bottom, like a priest's cope. I should, perhaps, describe it more exactly by saying that it was like the Virgin of the Hermits. The outline of the images was slightly hollow, as if they had been formed with a punch, but were very boldly drawn. MLLE. André asked me to notice certain details of the costume, but I refused to look at it any longer. I was ashamed of my credulity, feeling sure that the Blessed Virgin would hardly concern herself with instantaneous photographs on hailstones. I said, "But do you not see that these hailstones have fallen on vegetables, and received these impressions? Take them away, they are no good to me." I returned to my book, without giving further thought to what had happened. But my mind was disturbed by the singular formation of these hailstones. I picked up three in order to weigh them, without looking closely. They weighed between 6 and 7 ounces. One of them was perfectly round, like balls with which children play, and had a seam all around it, as though it had been cast in a mold.